What's up, this your boy Lil Duval, and check out my podcast, Conversations with Unc, on the Black Effect Podcast Network. Each and every Tuesday, Conversations with Unc podcast feature casuals and in-depth talk about ebbs and flows of life and the pursuit of happiness. Unlike my work on stage, I tap into a more serious and sensitive side to give life advice and simply offer words of encouragement, yet remind folks to never forget to laugh. Every Tuesday, listen to Conversations with Unc, hosted by Lil Duval on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Presented by AT&T. Connecting changes everything.
Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Signing up and playing is so easy. Simply sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you can get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matter more than ever. Place your moneyline, prop, and parlay bets with a king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. That's right, up to $1,500. Again, sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park. That's 1-800-GAMBLER.
You're listening to 100 Words or Less with Ray Harkins.
Hello, podcast humans. Welcome to yet another episode of the show where we discuss why punk, hardcore, indie rock, emo, metal is so important to us and the lifeblood that we all cling on to. Like if this DIY music scene was a tree, we're all branches hanging off of it, right? What a beautiful metaphor. I am thrilled to bring you this discussion because he's been on my laundry list of people to come on the show, and we finally did it. This is Wes Isold from American Nightmare, Cold Cave, and Some Girls. Let's not forget that. He is a person I've personally looked up to, his art and his creative path, because he definitely has, gone to the beat of his own drummer and really shifted the way that a lot of people I know think about like punk and hardcore and like the style in which American Nightmare approached what they were doing. It definitely shifted a lot of people's perspectives, including my own. And so Wes was great. And we had an in-depth discussion about all things American Nightmare, all things Cold Cave, all things him as a human being, because that's why I do this podcast. If you are a strong listener of this show, or even if you are a passive listener, I request this free help for the show. First of all, you can always email me, 100wordspodcast@gmail.com. Love to have feedback and people just saying what's up. All that stuff is definitely appreciated. You can also leave a rating and review on the Apple Podcasts page if you are listening to it on there, or even if you're not, doesn't matter. You can just dip in and leave a review. You can leave a rating on Spotify, and all of those things help this show get discovered by the people who need to hear about it. And that is the best way that you can support this show, because, you know, I don't ask for money, don't do a Patreon, don't do any of that stuff. So it would be helpful if you did those things. I want to just dive into this conversation because, there's a lot of things on my mind right now in regards to, I'm going through some shifts personally as far as new job's going to be starting, and going to be going out to the New England Metal and Hardcore Festival to do a series of podcasts and then maybe a few live podcasts, all of that fun stuff. But there's just a lot going on. So that is why I'm not going to pontificate about anything right here. And let's just discuss Wes as a human being. And interview form, I think. That's what we do, right? Yes. Anyways, here's Wes. I will talk to you after the conversation is over to let you know who's coming on next week, because that's what I always do in case you just basically bail right after the interview is done. Just stick around for another like minute, maybe 2 minutes most. So here we go. Here's Wes.
existing on the West Coast, you know, when American Nightmare first started to pop off, I think you definitely captured a lot of people's imaginations as far as like, oh, cool. Like, this is what hardcore can sound like now, as opposed to, you know, just kind of rehashing the same stuff over and over. And when you guys first came over here, like, I distinctly remember a show that I watched you guys at the Ojai Women's Center in Ojai.
Yeah.
And that was, it just felt so desperate for you guys playing, because there was this, I don't know, just this intensity where you guys were like, I don't even know if we're going to be a band. Like, and of course, this is kind of, you know, sort of revisionist historying it.
Sure, yeah.
Like, but that, it seems like, and multiple times that I saw you play in that original iteration, it seemed like that almost every single show. I'm going to guess that obviously was kind of generically the feeling of like, oh, this could be our last tour, or who knows.
I think it was just so in the moment and never even thought about, like, the fact that I played shows a few days ago is insane to me. I do think part of the impact that the band had was that sort of desperation and in the moment spontaneity of not knowing when it would combust. I mean, I knew it eventually would at some point, but really it was a no past, no tomorrow sort of thing. We're just doing it. And so much so that there was all these things that I think you can only sort of exist in that type of band when you are in that mindset, like not considering anything else in the world. Like, I never knowing where you were going to sleep or what you were getting paid or if you were getting paid or what you would eat or if you would eat, things like that. You could only do that if you literally don't care. And that was sort of the motif of the whole thing. Just didn't care. And I think that transpired into our performances and yeah, what was attractive about the band. And I mean, going back to what you said about like the way it sounded or the way it was looked or the way it was presented, I think there was elements of different facets of subgenre hardcore related, like microcosms, but didn't really dedicate itself to just one of those sounds. Like, you know, it wasn't just like a fast, like straight edge band, and definitely wasn't like a metal influence band, but it was like, it had the ferocity of maybe like what harder sort of like metal tinge hardcore bands had. But I think the desperation of it made it like more violent in a way. So like people who liked sort of harder hardcore were a little confused by it at first, but it ended up ultimately kind of making sense to them. And then I think people who liked faster hardcore felt the same. Like, it wasn't what they had previously been like listening to, but it was close enough and something new. And I don't know. I mean, I loved coming to California those first few times. It felt like we were in like a new world, and it was just fun to explore that world.
Yeah. Oh, I agree. And honestly, like as a person, I mean, cause like, I'm 42 years old, and like watching like, it takes every, you know, whatever, 3 to 5 years to watch a band, you know, kind of emerge that, you know, maybe either younger than you or the same age, where it just kind of gives you that little shot in the arm. And I think to your point, exactly what you're talking about, where it's like, you know, you guys plus many of your peers kind of gave that push for people to think, you know, in a different way about like that, you know, survival mode of just like, oh yeah, like, you know, we don't know if we're going to come through here again. And it always kind of felt like there were certain bands you knew you were going to be able to see again, but it always felt like with American Nightmare, there's like, I don't know, man, this could be the last time they play out here. Who knows?
That's really funny. Yeah. Like a few weeks ago, maybe a couple months ago, our guitar player, Brian Masick, he sent me a photo of the Ojai Women's Club. And like in my like lifelong naivety, I thought he was, I knew he was in Ohio in Ojai, and I thought he was like romanticizing it and just sending me a picture of it. And I was like, oh, that's so great. You went to look at it. And he's like, what? No, I was eating at a restaurant across the street and looked up and noticed it was right there. So,
yeah. Okay. Yeah. He wasn't like Google image searching where it's like, hey, Wes, remember this show? It's like, yeah, oh, man.
That's what I thought. I mean, that's the head I'm living in, but yeah.
No, I love that. I love that. We'll pull on some of those threads a little bit later, but, you know, reflecting on you as a person, I know that, you know, you've expressed this on many different interviews and podcasts and what have you in regards to, you know, your dad growing up in the Navy and obviously being a Navy brat, moving every so often because of the different assignments and everything like that. I'm going to kind of, I mean, I would say play armchair psychologist, but like some version of that where, because of that, were you kind of forced to be introverted in a way because you just couldn't expend the energy of like, yo, I got to make new friends now because we move every 2 years? Or
absolutely. I mean, okay. I remember a distinct cutoff in mood as a child. And it was on the last day of, I'm shedding no tears here. I just distinctly remember it was the last day of fifth grade. And it was the longest I had ever lived somewhere. It was like first through fifth grade. I was in Virginia Beach. And we literally moved on the last day of school. And that was kind of like the age when you start turning into like a human. Like I was listening to lots of music by then, and I had friends for a few years, and it was just like torn on that day. And I think ever since that day, I definitely had more of an inner dialogue than outward. And from that moment on, it was moving every year or every 2 years. And I relied heavily on music through that time. Just that, you know, that was sort of like my go-to way of coping.
Sure. That was your companion. Cause that, I mean, clearly that can travel with you. Whereas like, you know, your best friends that you made for that year, like can't.
Yeah. And like now it's weird because, you know, I'll see people who I haven't seen, you know, and like how everyone does, you see people you haven't seen in years, but it feels like no time's passed because you're aware of like their life through different facets of, you know, communication. But, you know, back then it was just literally, you'll never see this person again.
Right. Totally. Yeah. It's a very distinct cutoff where it's just like, man, yeah, I often think where it's like, man, I wonder what happened to my friend in fourth grade. It's like, well, no way to, I mean, maybe I can find him on Facebook or whatever, but yeah, it's very true. It's a very distinct cutoff.
Yeah. And at the same time, like sometimes they like appear now and I'm like, who are you? You know, but like, but it seems so traumatic then.
Totally. You're like, wait, are we expected to just like step into, I guess, playing basketball now? Cause that's what we did in fourth grade or whatever. Yeah,
yeah, exactly.
Right. Right. And what was your, I mean, I know like your dad was in the Navy, and did you have a, I guess, family structure at home? Like was mom in the house, and do you have any brothers and sisters? I wasn't aware.
I have a younger sister. She's 3 years younger than me. My mother was in the house. She had jobs here and there. Like she was an educator and sometimes picked up teaching jobs depending on how long we were around somewhere.
Right.
But, and, you know, on paper, it was pretty, pretty traditional.
Sure. And what was the I guess your favorite stop as you were in your travels when you were younger like that?
I mean, it just sort of anywhere that we landed where there was culture, where I thought I could get one step closer to what I loved, which was like music by way of like skateboarding or something. So you know, for growing up in Virginia Beach was very cool. Like it was heavy surf and skate and BMX culture. And, you know, that's where you first saw like punks in the mall and stuff like that. And then, you know, I lived in Florida, which was similar. I lived in Germany, which had great stuff going on. And then, you know, between those moves, I lived like in literal cornfields in Pennsylvania and in Maine.
Right.
So, you know, those times were, it's weird because those times were, I was certainly unimpressed and not into where I was, but I absorbed more in those places than anywhere else. So like in a way, I'm really thankful for those years in more or less isolation. And, you know, the people I was friends with, I only knew for a year, maybe 2 years most, but I spent so much time absorbing music and books and records that, you know, I probably wouldn't be who I was today or I am today had I not been forced to, you know, look at cornfields for years, you know?
Sure. Absolutely. And I think, I mean, I'm sure I know you can probably experience this as well when you start to tour and you start to experience all of these different, you know, cities and suburbs that you're playing. Yes, it's exciting to play New York, LA, you know, Berlin, whatever, all these major, you know, markets, as they say in the business. But then, you know, when you have this random show in, you know, Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania, where it's like, you're like, what? Wow, 200 people showed up to this and everyone was losing their minds because of, to your point, just that geographic isolation in some capacity.
Yeah. And those are in a way the most special, because I can relate to living in those towns and awaiting some like hypothetical show that might happen, you know?
Right.
And
right.
And when it does, it's just so glorious and special. And then, you know, when I lived in this town called Topsom, Maine, where I graduated high school, I was there for 11th and 12th grade. I was booking shows there, and you know, I a few of them. And there was a club in New Hampshire I would do a couple at, and then there was some in like a neighbor's house that we did a couple in like his parents' attic, and like just wondering if the bands would show up. But like it made those shows even more special. Like, you know, you know the band's going to show up in New York or like the cities you mentioned. But and at the same time, you know, when we were, I think there was a shift in particular, like, I think our world of hardcore, like, you didn't really play those cities that much. It was a lot of suburban shows. You know, we weren't playing LA all the time. There was no LA venue. Like, the Smell had just opened. We played there like once, but like it was places like Ojai and Bakersfield and stuff like that, you know?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Cause yeah, those you would have the more, you know, quote unquote unconventional spaces where people would be throwing shows at a basement of a pizza place or whatever. So yeah.
Right. Like if I get that tour rowdy now, I'd be like, it's a wrap. I'm done. You know?
Yeah. You're like, I'm an adult. I'm not playing this place.
Yeah.
Totally. Totally. Yeah. You're like, someone didn't really think this out. I totally get it. forgive the morbid curiosity, but like you actually, correct me if I'm wrong, you were born without a hand, right? Like you did not lose that in some accident.
That's correct. Okay. That's correct. Yeah.
And, I'm going to guess that like you had to go through some sort of like occupational therapy or anything, how to, you know, kind of obviously handle life based around the fact that, like, you know, clearly most people have two hands.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I remember a few times, I think it was pretty haphazard. I don't think I was taken to too many like lessons or anything like that.
Sure,
I think it was just like, here's a couple options. You can explore them if you want. And then, and I don't think that was done that much. I think it was pretty much thrown to the wolves, like go figure it out, you know? And,
sure.
That's sort of been the way ever my whole life, go figure it out.
Right. And yeah, cause I think of that era, they're definitely, you know, it's like now if, I mean, say, you know, your child was born without some sort of appendage, like you would have, you know, this like really thought out process of like occupational therapy, you know?
Definitely. There's a support network for people now, you know? And I remember like when I had it, that wasn't, like when I got my first prosthesis or something, that wasn't really, I don't remember being surrounded by other children like that. Occasionally we go to the children's hospital down the street from where we live in Los Angeles. And there is a very dedicated, beautiful group that is dedicated strictly to people with these sort of cases similar to mine. And, you know, there's a whole network and you get to see other people and they'll bring in people like me or other older people who are doing things that they're into, and they'll say, look, it's not like there are options. Like you're not totally fucked. You can do this stuff.
Totally. But, yeah.
And it's interesting too, because in my experience in showing up at these places, it's more to sort of, plead your existence to the parents, you know, like your child who was born this way will have a date one day, you know, it's not like the world's not going to shun them totally. Like, don't fret too much.
Right.
But, you know, my parents were like, they were, their approach to it was like, they signed me up for everything. So like, okay, you're going to play baseball. You're going to play basketball. You're going to play this. Like I played soccer a lot of my life, but they also signed me up for, sports that were like pretty challenging for me. And I did them. I mean, they didn't like, I didn't have a connection with them and didn't pursue them.
Right.
But I did successfully try them and competed and did things, you know, swimming, like everything. But, it didn't really matter because by the time I was doing stuff like that, I was already in love with music.
Right. as the age old story goes, where it's just like, you know, you have that fork in the road moment of like, am I a sports kid or am I, you know, a punk and hardcore kid? Or
yeah. Whatever. It's like, I appreciate this, but deep in my heart, I'm a punk. You know? Right. So I got to go.
Right. And I do like, obviously, how that has evolved to where it's like, you know, now like people can celebrate the fact that they, you know, whatever, love Manchester City and like, obviously like are a punk and hardcore kid. Whereas like, you know, there was an era where it's like, dude, don't talk too much about your love for baseball. Like, just pay attention.
Yeah, absolutely. Or other music even, you know.
It's very true where it's like, yeah, you're allowed to like, you know, this particular bucket of bands. And it's like, of course you can like Joy Division, but don't you dare go down that Bauhaus road.
Totally. Yeah. I mean, yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
I mean, I remember like people, you know, when I was getting into punk, like literally saying, don't tell people you like the Smiths. Like that was a real conversation that was had with me by an older person. Like who was like, yeah, like they are good, but don't tell anyone, you know?
Yeah. Don't publicly admit that you like NXS's Kick. It's like, what? What are we talking about? Yeah.
Yeah.
And so when you were, you know, kind of just caring about school or like attending school, like did you, you know, I guess, were you academically inclined? Did you like that aspect of your life or was it pretty much just torture from, you know, elementary school onward?
I did not like it. I was pretty numb throughout the whole thing. And I was there, I was present, but I didn't, I was just in my own head and thinking about my own stuff and pretty oblivious to anything that was going around me, everything that was going around me and just trying to survive and, you know, super self-conscious and just didn't want to rock the boat and just wanted to, keep absorbing what was speaking to me. And then, I got like very middle of the road grades. And then I had these weird situations where, I think I got like weird mercy good scores in certain classes just for existing and being there and not talking. You know, I always excelled in like English classes and was put in like AP classes for stuff like that. And I literally never did homework. I was buying records and listening to records. I could care less about this world. I was just sort of biding my time until I was set free. But I think I had the mercy of a few teachers
passing you through. Yeah.
Yeah. Who just like assumed I'd be okay in these subjects, you know?
Right. Right. And it's funny you say that because I do think that many people, once you kind of learn how to play the, you know, air quotes here, the game in regards to not saying that you were, you know, angling for just, you know, passing by on like any charm or whatever, but just like, when you learn how to be like, okay, this is the effort I put in, and then this is the grade that I get. And as long as you are maintaining that sort of level and understand that, like it really kind of unlocks that schooling component in most people's lives.
Yeah, exactly. And then of course, like in retrospect, you could have done far less and probably gotten better grades, you know.
Totally. Where it's like, what is the minimum effort that I can put in, but then obviously still go, you know, skating and go to shows on the weekend with my friends or whatever.
Exactly. I could have cared less, you know, it was not my cup of tea.
Yeah. And I'm guessing, was there any, you know, hope that you were going to, you know, enlist in the Navy or, you know, kind of follow along your father's footsteps, or was that a pretty clear, no, I'm not going to do that.
That was never spoken about. I think in part because I was born without a hand. And I think that was not a thing that you could even do at the time. You know, I don't think they were enlisting like amputees into the military in like the late 90s. I really don't think that was a thing. You know, you weren't even allowed to have tattoos upon enlisting.
Yeah. That's until a good point.
So I think, I think that coupled with my spirit was never a point of contention, you know, or a possibility. It was just non-existent.
Yeah. Well, it didn't need to have a conversation. I mean, it's like the, you know, whatever in Vietnam, people with flat feet. And it was like the same idea where it's like, hey guys, I literally don't have a hand. I cannot do whatever it is that you're potentially going to ask me to do.
Yeah. It's like, I'll shoot this gun. I'll probably miss that, you know?
Right. I can't say I'll be horribly accurate.
But I think like, you know, in like, in retrospect, I think I was holding on to this secret that I knew that I was going to have a life in music. And it was not something that I ever voiced or expressed interest in, aside from being obsessed with it. And I certainly was not encouraged to pursue that world by family or anyone that I had ever met in my life. It was just a personal thing that I had. And so I had to sort of just sit quietly and wait for this moment to arise where I was able to pursue it. And I think when you manifest such a love for something, you sort of make yourself available to people who come into your life and sort of provide channels for you to slip down. And that's what I did. So I had to suffer through school. I had to let my parents sort of search for a path for me that I knew I wasn't going to take. You know, they were like, here's a school here, or here's a school here. Like, you know, post high school, like you could go this route, you could do this thing. And I was just kind of shrugging like, I don't know. I don't think so, without ever saying what my plan was, because certainly a plan at that point that is not that attractive to a parental figure is I'm going to be in a hardcore band. And I know that that's going to provide a life for me. And, but I did have a sinking, intuitive feeling that that was the path I was going to take, and it would, and I would be fine. Mm-hmm. And, I don't know why it has been, but it's probably because I just knew it would be, as there was nothing else I was interested in or cared about at all. And my obsession and love for music and for punk and hardcore and sort of outsider counterculture world was really so obsessive that there was just no other option.
Rockabilia.com is the place where you can find Depeche Mode shirts. You can find Iron Maiden shirts, Black Sabbath, Bring Me the Horizon. I don't care what it is that you're into. You'll be able to find something for yourself or your friends or your family. And above all, you can use this promo code 100 words or less that gets you 10% off of your entire order. And that's important because not only are you saving money, but then you signify that marketing works and that this show has a devoted audience, you know, all of those things. It's a virtuous cycle that happens here. But Rockabilia ships from the Midwest here in the United States of America, has over 500,000 items, friendly customer service. Punk and hardcore kids work there. Ticks all the boxes as far as I'm concerned. So Rockabilia is a place that you should support, and go to their website and use the promo code 100 words or less. Rockabilia.com. Have fun shopping for all of the merch. This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. We all carry around different things that stress us out, right? Like maybe it's something really, really small, like, man, that parking space, it's always taken. And I wish that I would be able to like get it instead of, you know, this person that maybe, you know, is the most courteous and considerate. I know that's something very random, but it's true. We all experience different things throughout the day that trigger us in so many different ways. And there are many times where I have been like, I wish that I had a spot or a repository for me to, you know, get this stuff off of my chest. Because if you bottle it up, that is no bueno. And then all of a sudden you explode on a coworker or a friend or a family member being like, the parking spot. And people are like, what are you talking about? That is where therapy comes in. And I love working with BetterHelp because I'm a huge advocate for therapy, broadly speaking. So if you're thinking of starting therapy, please give BetterHelp a try. It is so easy because it's entirely online. It's designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. All you do is fill out a brief questionnaire, and then you get matched with a licensed therapist. And if you are not vibing with the therapist for any reason, you can switch it out at no additional charge. Get things off of your chest with BetterHelp. So visit betterhelp.com/ray today to get 10% off of your first month. That's betterhelp.com/ray.
When you're talking about that obsessive nature, like I think it's something that most people, especially too, like has subculture has become, you know, so mainstream, like they're, you know, whatever, picking on the Misfits, where it's like, you know, people are wearing their shirts and clearly have no clue like who the Misfits are, like just, and understanding the levels of where it's like, I'm not talking about 1, 2, 3 layers deep. You're like, I care about the most irrelevant, stupid information that is serving no purpose besides just like scratching that weirdo itch in my brain that I can't even explain to anybody who hasn't become obsessed with something.
Exactly. Exactly.
And what, I guess, set you on that path? Like, you know, I'm guessing that, you know, because you didn't have like an older sibling, and clearly it didn't sound like you had that much of a, you know, I mean, maybe you had a musical family, but, you know, it wasn't like your dad was handing you Bad Brains records or something like that. What was the introduction point? Just kind of like existing around, you know, different people at school and stuff like that?
No, not even. That was never it. It literally just the first time that I started, you know, hearing music as a child, it just felt right. It just filled something in me that I wasn't able to fill in any other way. And, I remember being very young, like 6, 7, and accidentally stumbling upon MTV one day on our TV in our home in Virginia. And, that moment changed my life, and I just never watched another channel again. Like, that was it. And I had to, like, I wasn't really allowed to watch it, so I had to like sort of sneak to watch it when I could. And it didn't matter what the video was or what the band was or what the song was. At first, it was just a world that I knew I wanted a part of, and it felt more, I felt more at home in right. this sort of fantastical musical world than my reality. And I was very young when I made that connection, and that was it.
Yeah. And when you say you weren't allowed, was this like a religious overtone, or did your parents just like, oh my gosh, this is, you know, not what Wesley not would go down?
Not religious, just more traditional, like conservative, you know?
Got it. Yeah. Yeah. This was showing him way too much.
Yeah. It was like, you know, it was like, girls, you know, or something, you know,
it's like, totally. Like my 8-year-old cannot watch this. Yeah,
exactly.
That's true. Especially when it's like, you start to maybe ask questions that are, you know, inappropriate at a dinner table, where it's like, you know, what is cherry pie? Like, I know it's a dessert, mom, but like, what does that mean?
Yeah. I mean, I think sketchier is I never asked a question. So I think it was just like, you know.
Right. Totally. Yeah. You're dropping it on random people at school, and they're just like, what is he talking about?
Yeah. I mean, it was, you know, and I think of hearing this different sort of music and then seeing older people who were like, you know, dressing the part and living it. I think it just felt beautiful to me that there were different ways you could go, you know, in life. And I knew that was a way I was going to go.
Yeah, absolutely. And like you said, once you became obsessed with music, that was the only path. And you said you put on shows, like, you know, were you obviously just, you know, bringing whatever local punk and hardcore bands to, you know, have a spot there? Like, what was your most quote unquote successful show that you threw yourself?
Probably the most successful show I did. I booked a show. I was in high school still, and it was Converge and Overcast and Disembodied.
I remember that tour.
Exactly. So I did a show in New Hampshire for that. And then, I did a, you know, I would call the numbers inside 7 inches and demo tapes and invite bands to come play. And every now and then they took me up on it. Like, I remember it was New Year's Eve, I'm guessing 1998, maybe 99, but like I did a show for the Enkindles.
Oh, yeah.
And, in my friend's attic above his garage in this small town in Maine that, like, you know, maybe like 120 people showed up to. And, you know, I think it was a great show, but it was like in the middle of nowhere, and I couldn't believe the band showed up, you know.
That's incredible. Yeah. I love those. I mean, the reason I got specific about that is because I just love those moments of where you feel so excited that you were able to pull this off, and then, you know, everybody, whatever, kid showed up, band showed up. Like, it just feels like it's such a moment that you can't, it becomes difficult to describe how cool that is.
It's the coolest. And like, you know, bless these people for like driving to these unknown suburbs in the middle of nowhere and playing, you know,
right. It
changes lives.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm guessing that, like, you know, as you became more, you know, enmeshed and putting on shows and, you know, caring even more about, you know, punk and hardcore and that subculture, were you, I'm going to guess that, like, you weren't immediately taken by the idea of playing in a band, or was that, you know, once you started to witness that, you were very excited about trying to put something together?
No, I just wanted it all. So like right when I had sort of stepped past the peripheral edges of punk, which is just, you know, buying like classic first albums, you know, and finding out that, like, for me, you know, the trajectory was you get like the classic records first, and then you find out that you're coexisting in a timeline where it's happening around you. And then it's a matter of just finding out what that is. And it doesn't matter if the bands are good or bad, just that they exist is enough. And once you find that out, you're exposed to this whole world of like local bands and zines and shows. And for me, it was just a matter of, I wanted it all. I didn't want to just do one of them, or I just wanted as much as I could partake in. So I did do bands right away, and this is or attempted to it, rather, I guess, you know. Someone wrote to me recently actually and said they have a video of me, I'm probably 13 in it, and I'm singing, it's on a military base in Stuttgart, Germany, and I'm singing like Misfits and Sex Pistols covers with like my ninth grade fellow students who knew about that music. And so I had tried to do a band as early as ninth grade. And then that continued again in 10th grade. I probably played like one to two shows of cover songs. And then I moved to Maine, 11th grade. I was asked to sing in like a few like bands that did nothing, tried. They were no good, but I was like on the path to doing it, but it just wasn't there yet. And then shortly after that, I mean, I had graduated high school for like maybe a year and a half when American Nightmare started. So
I was
just sort of waiting until the right thing appeared, and that was it. And that's when I guess opened up, you know?
Sure. Absolutely. Yeah. When you were able to, you know, have something that was a little more serious than what you had previously experienced.
Yeah. And I think like when you hear the music that coerces you into opening up, you know, that hadn't happened before that, you know?
Right. I really like how you put, I mean, it's true, because like, especially too, like what you're talking about, where your first band experiences are, you know, you're just operating off of pure, like, okay, I want to rip off like these three bands or whatever. And you're just like, you're operating off of pure instinct in a, not a bad way, but in a very calculated way. Whereas like, when you do get surrounded by people who all of a sudden unlock whatever it is like that you're doing together, that's when it's like, oh my gosh, like this is what I've tried to arrive at.
That's exactly right. And that's magic that can happen, you know, cause you don't know that you have that inside of you. I had this like, you know, I don't know, less than 20 years of life experience at the time, but it was my experience. But I didn't know that that's what I would articulate once given music that sort of brought that out of me, you know?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. It's beautiful. I know that you've expressed this not only lyrically, but, you know, spoken about in interviews that your, you know, inability to, you know, air quote, get comfortable in whatever station you're at in life. And it seems like that, especially towards the end of American Nightmare, where it was just like the, you know, level of comfort that you had was like non-existent. You're like, I got to get out of here. I'm guessing that was something that, you know, you obviously just had to do based on like, I'm not going to be around if I still continue to, you know, behave the way that I am and like the mental state that I'm in.
Yeah, it was very unhealthy at that point because for several reasons. We had just run ourselves into the ground with like extensive touring. You know, we were pretty much a nonstop band, making no money, but touring all the time. So, the physical toll that would take on you was pretty brutal, even in my early 20s. And then on top of that, I was just not uncomfortable. I was drinking at the time, and like I had to do that to even cope because I was so unhappy at that point. Then you have the pressure of not wanting to let down the people who have invested time into this project with you. And then on top of that, you know, as bands grow, there's different things and moves that people want to make or encourage you to make that aren't really totally in line with your initial core interest of why you want to play music in the first place. So we had sort of grown this band to this level where it was sort of, we were like, okay, you can either just stay doing the same thing, repeating yourself, or you try to grow, which seems like the natural thing to do. But that growth means taking steps into worlds where you don't really want to be. So American Nightmare was pretty popular at the time for like, you know, a hardcore band that was mm-hmm. playing pretty relatively traditional hardcore, but like we still weren't like a Warped Tour type band or like a more melodic punk band. And I think those would have been like the logical next steps a band would want to take, but that's just not what I wanted to do. I didn't want to really pursue those avenues. And my taste in music had surpassed what I was playing. And I just wanted to try different things, you know?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. I mean, especially when you, that dovetails nice into another question I was going to ask in regards to, you know, not only American Nightmare, but clearly a lot of other things that you have done since with, you know, Cold Cave, Heartworm Press, where the business implications, like, and I, you know, that's just something as simple as, you know, getting, putting on a show and paying, you know, Converge $200 for playing a basement or whatever.
Exactly.
So like, it sounds like you were relatively comfortable with that aspect of it, like understanding that there are, you know, I mean, even if it's small stakes, like financial implications in the business side of things, did you, I guess, like those aspects of, you know, American Nightmare? And then as you were, you know, growing in other different areas?
What do you mean? Like, did I like, or was I comfortable in understanding of the financial aspect of it?
Exactly. Yeah. Did you like the business side of the, you know, the music and obviously everything you've done since?
No, and not at all, actually. Okay. And I think my whole approach to that has been like, has like strangely worked in my favor, but my whole thing was just never considering it and never thinking about it. And like, I just jumped into everything I did and have done to this day without considering the financial aspects or ramifications or debt incurred by anything I've ever chosen to do. I was just, if it's something I wanted to do, I just figured out how to do it. And it was that simple. And, you know, which often meant a loss,
right?
Financially.
Sure.
But but to me, it wasn't a matter of like, I never saw the worth as just like on a scale of money. It was like, I'm going to lose money doing this, but it's going to be such a monumental moment for me. It's something I care so passionately about that the worth like just is triple the loss. So, and I sort of live my life that way, you know, like even to this day that like I'm putting out these books that I think are so important and they're books I want to own, but they don't make money often. And some do and some don't, but it's not really the point that I think the worth of this book existing is worth more than like the money that it costs to make it exist. Even for tours, like, you know, if a band that we love asks us to go support them, it may not pay what we would make on our own, but it's just something that we want to do because we find it important to do for like the legacy of this band or like in the lineage of music and what's maybe saved us in the past personally, that we're going to give back to this artist, whether or not it cripples you momentarily. And I think that's been such a benefit to me and to everything I've been a part of, because I've never let money be a deciding factor in what we do, you know? And I think like, you know, I was speaking about this recently, but my very first American Nightmare show that ever happened, I booked the show, and I went and found a church that would let me book the show in it in Portland, Maine. And they told me how much it would be. And it was like, you know, I think it was $400 for the room. And then I had to rent a PA for like $200. And, you know, when you're 20 years old, like $600 is a lot of money. And like, definitely that money didn't come through the door that night, but I somehow hustled enough money to pay those bills. And it didn't matter that I lost money on the show. I'm in a band now, and I just played a show, and it was fucking sick. And, right. I'm good. Like, and I've lived my life like that, you know?
You know them and you love them. And if you don't know them, I am making you aware of them. And that is evilgreed.net. They are an amazing web store solution for bands, record labels, all to ship stuff out to you, the consumer. I know that may be slightly confusing, but follow along here. You order stuff, they send you stuff. And they act like a record label because they have a very curated list of bands and labels that they work with. But before I let you know about that list of bands and labels, you need to use this promo code. So you type in evilgreed.net, you type in 100 words at checkout, and you will get 10% off of your entire order, which is a deal. I mean, let's be honest. You're spending $100, I give you $10. That's basically like me taking you out for, you know, lunch, like, you know, how about a Sahi bowl or something like that. Anyways, Evil Greed is based in Berlin, Germany, and they work with labels like Triple B, Flat Spot, Sergeant House, Maggot Stomp, so many cool things. Basically, if it operates under the banner of what I would define as sort of like artistic heavy stuff, that is what they do. And they work with bands like Power Trip and Nails and so many cool things. Trust me in saying you will get lost on their website in the best way possible. And they ship it to you very fast. In Berlin, Germany, the shipping rates are very advantageous for us here in the United States. It does not cost an arm and a leg to get something to you. So if you want to buy the latest vinyl, long sleeves, hoodies, whatever it is, order it from evilgreed.net and you will be highly satisfied. And again, use the promo code 100 words. Thank you for your continued support, Evil Greed.
Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Signing up and playing is so easy. Simply sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you can get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matter more than ever. Place your moneyline, prop, and parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets. If you don't win your first bet, that's right, up to $1,500. Again, sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park. That's 1-800-GAMBLER.
You open up your aperture enough to like execute the idea. And then afterwards you can, you know, pick up the pieces if there are pieces left and then be able to be like, okay, like I can do that again versus like, oh, I can do that again. Except, you know, maybe I just do it a little differently this way.
Yeah. And that's the worth in everything, you know, that's always been first, you know?
Yeah. No, that's realistically like, you know, how art and commerce, you know, in most people's opinions should collide, where it's like the art is dictating the commerce as opposed to vice versa.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah.
And so it also seems to me like your interest in literature, you know, speaking about Heartworm and obviously all of the, you know, lyrical content that you have pulled from in the past has been something that's been long running, or was that something that, you know, kind of started to jump in your life in your, you know, late teens, early 20s, as far as, you know, just your love for reading and the consumption of that stuff?
I think it was just parallel to music. It was just another world that just made sense to me. The lyrical aspect of music was more important to me than music, than the sound of music. Of course, that combination is what made it so appealing, but it was people singing things that I felt that I wasn't able to articulate that changed my life. And that crossed over into poetry that spoke to me. And it's all just been sort of under the same umbrella to me. And it's just what I care about and I want to give back to. And I don't know. I just don't see that much of a difference between them. Especially when sort of digging through the past with like older poetry of like deceased people, you know, there weren't these like worlds of music to help them get their ideas across. And maybe these people would have been musicians, who knows, but there really is no difference between what they were trying to put out into the world and express as opposed to like, you know, some of my favorite lyricists now, you know?
Yeah, no, it's a good point. It's like the vehicle may not have existed. And so it's like,
exactly.
Right. So this is how they're going to express themselves. Yeah. Once your life shifted out to LA, and obviously, especially with, you know, your expression of music via Cold Cave, it seems to me like you can conduct your creative pursuits and like the business aspect at a more, you know, comfortable clip where like, you know, with American Nightmare, where you're like, oh yeah, you know, we're touring 200 to 250 days out of the year and that sort of stuff. How did you, I guess, learn how to, you know, take that shift of being like, okay, that what I was doing with American Nightmare wasn't sustainable. Was that a long process for you to kind of understand how to apply that towards your future endeavors?
Yeah. I mean, it's complicated because, you know, like Cold Cave exists in a more traditional music industry world.
Sure.
So if you were to operate this band in the way that like American Nightmare did, touring all the time, it would just destroy it. So you sort of have to like nurture it, baby it, and understand that its worth isn't just in, you know, playing that many shows a year. It's more like making special choices that are going to be rewarding to you and to the people who are coming to see it. You know, there's I don't know. I mean, I guess I still struggle with it too, because when I'm home for too long, I do get antsy and I am so used to being on the move that it's sometimes difficult for me to, if I don't have like a tour booked, it's stressful to me, you know, but I do things to sort of align my schedule into the future. For example, Cold Cave just got off tour with Depeche Mode. And before that tour happened, I knew that if I come right off that tour, I'm going to be in such a depressed state from how elated that experience was going to be, that I can't just come home and sit still and do nothing. So I booked American Nightmare shows to offset like that depression. Cause I was like that, I'm going to need that experience to center myself. Otherwise I'm just going to be sitting home all summer depressed. I can't do that. Somehow we're making it work, and somehow we're making it work whilst in that world, while still subscribing to the ethos that first spoke to me. You know, I have worked with labels of various degrees, but for the past like decade or so, I have been releasing my own music, and it's been really beneficial because we're given these, or we do sometimes get these like incredible opportunities, and they're only based on our own merit. Like, we don't have a manager or a booking agent or a label pitching us for these opportunities. Now, it's literally like Depeche Mode or Nine Inch Nails or someone in the stature being like, hey you, I want you to be on the tour, and that's it. And that's beautiful that that's able to happen from a place of our own hustle, which we learned from being young punks, you know?
No, absolutely. And I think that, you know, not only does that come through in the decisions that you make, the tours you make, and, you know, all of that is all rooted back to the fact that, like you said, there's that connectivity with the DIY nature of it, where it's like almost irregardless of the style of music that you're playing, you can apply those same principles, broadly speaking, over art in general.
Exactly. And you can. And I think, it comes with some sacrifices, but all of which have been worth it for me personally. I just, there have been times where I've tried to step into a mold and of a more traditional route against my better judgment. And it just, it's not a place I can exist in, you know? So, I don't heed well to, other people's expectations, and I'm not that great of a team player. So I kind of have to exist in this way just to keep existing.
Right. Yeah. This, the, you know, does not play well with others. It's like, mm-mm. Well, that's like something I've learned about myself, and like, I'm not going to bum anybody else out by doing this.
That's exactly right.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
And with that idea of, you know, like you mentioned some of the touring opportunities, like, you know, Cold Cave is definitely, you've been thrown in situations that, for one, you've either never been in before or, you know, might not ever experience again. Which kind of either tours or sets of shows that, you know, you have had the opportunity to, you know, dive into with Cold Cave have been the ones that have made you feel the most, you know, sort of fish out of water scenario?
Gosh, you know, I have to say, I don't actually feel like a fish out of water.
That's fine.
I do feel like everything has been manifested.
Sure.
And, it's just an extension of the, of love that me or Amy have given to this band and to the music that we love. So, when we found ourselves on tours with like the Jesus and Mary Chain or Ministry or Nine Inch Nails or Depeche Mode, it just feels actually kind of natural to us because, it's like, of course that's what is going to happen because that's what we care about, you know? And,
right.
And when we've been so open to the world and it came back to us. And so, yeah, like these aren't situations that we experience in our own world on our own tours, but, we feel totally comfortable stepping in there and performing on stages like that or to crowds of that magnitude. It doesn't really shake us. I don't know. I just feel like this is what we do. And it doesn't matter if there's 100 people or like 100,000 people, it's just, we're doing what we do regardless, you know?
Yeah. Oh, for sure. And kind of on that same tip as well, where when, you know, AN first started to do the, you know, reunion shows, you know, many, many years ago. And, you know, so you start to have the fire to, you know, put out more music. And I think there really has been a deliberate nature to what you guys are doing, where it's not just this, you know, old man, hardcore tour nostalgia act, because, you know, clearly you're putting out new music and there's vitality still involved with it. I'm going to guess that there was, you know, especially once you started to come back, there was that temptation of being like, oh yeah, we can just like kind of do this now. And like, we don't even need to really think about all these other, you know, expressions. But, you know, I know that it wasn't the path you went down, but I'm sure that there was a, you know, slight temptation to kind of do that maybe.
What do you mean? Just to like,
yeah, just basically be like, okay, like, you know, yeah, we can whatever do the, you know, quote unquote cash grab of, you know, hardcore festivals and all that sort of stuff,
but right,
tarnish the legacy of the band or whatever.
Yeah. I mean, I think I never felt that. So I felt that, it was something to be precious with. And, it only could serve anyone if it was done from a place of love. And, you know, we were asked to do things that we said no to. Like when AN got back together, we were asked to play Coachella. We said no. It was not something that we wanted to experience and wasn't something that I wanted to do with this band. And I had already played that festival at this point, and I was like, this isn't a good idea. This isn't going to be fun. It's not what this band is about. I don't want to do this. But then, like, you know, if a more like sort of punk-esque fest asked us to play, we would consider it. And, you know, I think when we first got back together, not everyone was on the same page. So there wasn't a real plan to for us to come together as a unit and try to collect on it really fast. You know, we really weren't like a cohesive thing until a few years after our reunion, so to speak. Mm-hmm. So, and by the time where we started making new music, we everyone who was in the band at that point was on the same page. And we did want to be careful about it. And we did want to play music that spoke to who we were now, as opposed to just music that we made when we were younger or something.
Yeah.
And I think like the new record that we made is probably, you know, it's for me, I like it the most of almost anything we've ever done, aside from like the first two 7-inches that we, you know, those, that would be my favorite material that we've done. You know, there's songs on every record that I feel a connection with, but there is a immediacy to these new songs and how they were written and how they were recorded and how they came together so natural that I'm just really proud of it. And I can't, it's like part of me is surprised that it sounds the way it does. And there's so much life in it because it's like you said, like on paper, it's like, it's just an old man band making like music that's referential to what their idea of hardcore may have been 20 years ago or something. And it doesn't feel that way to me at all. It feels very natural. And when I'm making music for Cold Cave, I labor over the lyrical content of it. It doesn't always come so quick to me, but like when I'm making American Nightmare music and my role is like so clear cut and understood that I just need to sing on these fucking songs, that it sort of just like falls out of thin air and it exists. And then I'm pleasantly surprised that I'm able to conjure that still and that I have something to say.
Yeah.
And in that way, you know, because I when I first stopped doing this band, stopped doing like some girls and bands like that, I thought I was at this point in my life where I just didn't want to like, I didn't want to like be loud. You know, I didn't want to like scream anymore. And I thought like, it meant like, maybe like screaming means you're mentally ill and I don't want to be mentally ill anymore. I don't want to be like, I don't see a difference between like standing on a stage and screaming and like that person sitting on a corner screaming, you know, I didn't want to subscribe to that, but I've found a comfortable way of, or a way that's comfortable to me anyway, to let that out. And I feel a healthy way, you know?
Yeah. Oh, for sure. No. Well, and I just like that idea of being like, being able to put yourself into something where it's like my, like you said, my role is so clearly defined. I can exist in this space and I feel comfortable existing in this space. And it's easy for me to do this because I know my role to play.
Yeah. So there's that. And then there's the major factor of it is what happens like inside these rooms during shows, and that it is that there are these different people from different walks of life and that they're all there for different but probably similar reasons of varying definition, and that people are able to get something out of this sound and this emotion that makes this band existing like 100% worth it. And if that weren't such a major aspect of the band, like the live situation, it definitely wouldn't exist. And we definitely wouldn't play shows. And that's why, you know, in the past we've been like, okay, that's not the show for us to play, or that's not the fest for us to play, because we're not going to get that experience out of it. It's not going to be a communal experience. And, you know,
yeah, there's no reason for you to do this if you didn't actually want to do this, because yeah, the band ostensibly doesn't need to do what it does unless there is a real reason behind it at this point.
Exactly. And it's like, you know, it's not like this band is not like anyone's like career or job. It's not why like everyone involved is totally fine doing like not doing it, you know, like if we didn't get that out of it, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. The last two things I want to hit on was the idea of Heartworm Press, and you know, realistically, I mean, I definitely compare what you're doing to you know, something like Feral House, where it's just like you guys are, you know, the publishing houses are focused on, you know, subculture art. The idea of outsiders, whether it's poetry or whether it's just the subject matter that they're covering. But I'm going to guess that a lot of the operating principles of what you were doing when you first started to publish either your own work through Heartworm or then obviously, open that up to other people. did it feel like basically kind of starting a band in a way, as far as like, okay, well, I got to figure out who to print this stuff through and that sort of stuff? Or was this an entirely kind of new endeavor that you were when you first started?
I guess it was similar to the steps you would take when you're putting out. Yeah. If you were in a new band and you wanted to go make a demo tape first you would just go to like Kinko's or Staples or something and steal a bunch of paper and photocopy it for free and walk out and not pay a dime. You know, it was like, that's how like the zine started. And then when it moved more into like book world, I had people who I work with to this day who are from punk and hardcore who were able to be like, oh, this is like the printer you should use. And the first printer I use that I made Deathbeds with is the printer I use to this day. So there wasn't much exploration I had to do post that. And these people are really hands-on and they're wonderful printers. And I got lucky that I knew someone who knew this printer. And I don't know. It's like, there's a lot more that if I only had to concentrate on this press, there's a lot more that could be done in terms of like marketing and finding more stores to carry it. But at the same time, I like that people who it's meant for tend to find it. And I think our music is kind of like that. Like you mentioned, like, I'm not good at plugging myself or like selling myself. We just kind of stay the course and do what we do. And luckily it resonates with people and they tend to come find us. And that's just a more comfortable place for us to exist in, whether it's Cold Cave or American Nightmare or putting out books by people we admire. It is all an extension of your first steps into like the world of DIY, you know, and the fact that it's sort of bloomed into this whole thing is just a testament to I think our deep care of it all, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And the last thing is, you know, being a father and watching the world through someone else's eyes, sounds like a cliche, but it clearly changes people. How does that make you reflect on like, you know, either your upbringing or the fact that, you know, at some point your kid is going to look at, you know, whether it's your books, your music or whatever, and be like, yo, dad, that sucks. Like, you know, like the rebellion nature is going to exist in some capacity. Is that something that you've either, you know, put any mental thought towards, or is it basically just like, well, we'll cross that bridge when we get to it?
No, I mean, my whole life, people have told me I suck at everything I do. So I'm not going to like change that no matter what. So
right.
It doesn't really have that much of an impact on it. I mean, there's things, I mean, I think like my relation to that is more like, I guess I feel like an early sense of, not regret, but like I don't want my child to ever feel as terrible in life as I've felt. And it's difficult for me that I've recorded that sensation and that they're going to have to understand that and or choose not to, which is fine too, but it is all there. And like, I think if anything, a goal of mine now would be to stay alive, to kind of say that, just to stay alive as an example that these are real emotions that people can have and they can overcome them. You know? Mm-hmm.
Right. It's like the idea that even though my, you know, trauma, grief, everything has been kind of, you know, spilled out via art, like I'm still standing and I'm still, you know, present as I can be for, you know, you and all the people that I care about.
Yeah, and the beauty of it is that it has helped people, and that's all that really matters.
And that is that. Wes, really appreciate you coming on the show, and to his publicist of the stars, Stephanie Marlowe, who is a previous guest of the show. Shout out to her because she always brings the heat, brings the good ideas to me to be like, hey, we should do this. I'm like, you know what? Yes, we should. Next week is, this is a little bit left of center conversation, but follow along here. You'll understand me. This is Christina Ward, who is the, I guess, CEO, I don't know what her actual title is, head honcho of Feral House Publishing. And I felt like this was a nice dovetail to the conversation that we had with Wes here, because Wes has published a ton of books, works under the moniker Heartworm Press. And Feral Ward, I know it came into my orbit just noticing that they publish a lot of books on sort of, you know, deviant art, a lot of things in relation to just the subcultures, as it were. And so Christina, I always found to be an interesting individual. She's published a lot of books, and she pursues a lot of people who are interesting voices that should have a book inside of them. And she works with them to pull it out. And yeah, anyways, they publish like Lords of Chaos, done a variety of different topics on, Satanism. They've published some of Eugene Robinson from Oxbow's stuff. It's just, yeah, it's a really, really good independent publishing house that has its roots within punk and hardcore and all the subcultures that we love. So anyways, that is what's up. That's what we have next week. Christina Ward from Feral House Publishing. And until then, please be safe, everybody. The show is sponsored by BetterHelp. Trust me in saying that no matter who you are, mental health challenges can affect you, and how you manage them can make all of the difference. That's why everyone should have access to mental health support that meets them where they are and helps them get through. BetterHelp provides online therapy on your schedule. It's flexible, simple to use, and more affordable than in-person therapy. Connect with a licensed therapist selected just for you. Learn more at BetterHelp.com. That's BetterHelp.com.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus.
Terms and conditions apply. See website for details. This is Malcolm Gladwell from Revisionist History. eBay Motors is here for the ride. With some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Brake kits, LED headlights, whatever you need, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.